Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today, wow, we are tackling something truly monumental. Our deep dive today is titled The Federal News Update for Saturday, August 23rd, 2025. And our mission here, it's a critical one, is to deliver a really thorough, comprehensive, and frankly, granular report on each and every action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of August 20, 2025. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's a very short window, right? Just a few days. But believe me, it is absolutely packed with critical developments. We're going to pull back the curtain on these events, talking not just about what happened, but really digging deep into their, well, their profound impact and all the intricate implications.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. It's great to be here for this. What's really striking, Alex, even in this incredibly brief period, just August 20th to the 23rd, is how the actions we're seeing, they're not random at all. Not really. They clearly signal a deliberate and strategic direction for this administration. If you look at the executive summary of our sources, this period is just defined by rapid, really top-down policy implementation. We're seeing a concerted effort towards, well, centralization of executive authority, a definite acceleration of deregulation across some key sectors, and a firm assertion of a unilateral, very sovereignty-focused posture, both domestically and internationally. And the crucial part, all of this has unfolded within a context of, well, remarkable legislative inertia. Congress has been quiet.
Okay, let's unpack this, because those are some weighty themes right off the bat, especially that legislative inertia. But let's start with the executive actions. These directives and administrative priorities that really kicked off this this whirlwind period. Okay, first up, we've got this really intriguing initiative launched on August 21st, 2025. There was an executive order titled Improving Our Nation Through Better Design. This order, it basically gave birth to the America by Design initiative. And the aim seems to be a complete overhaul of how Americans interact with government services, you know, from websites to actual physical spaces. Now, on the surface, it sounds like a push for better aesthetics, better usability, which, let's be honest, a lot of federal services could definitely use, right? I mean, I remember trying to navigate a government website just last month, trying to update a, well, never mind what document. And it was, oh, painful. I definitely thought this needs a designer. Yeah. But what you're describing, it sounds like it goes way beyond just making things look pretty, doesn't it? Is this really just about, you know, a facelift? Or are we looking at something deeper, a more strategic move, maybe? Centralizing control.
That's a great question. And yeah, you've really hit the nail on the head there. The administration stated a reason for America by Design. It definitely goes beyond just making things look nice. They argue pretty openly that government services have, quote, lagged behind in usability and aesthetics, and that this leads to, you know, a poor user experience and, importantly, high maintenance costs for all those clunky old systems. So the stated policy is actually quite ambitious. It's to deliver digital and physical experiences that are both beautiful and efficient. The goal being to improve quality of life and, crucially, enhance public trust in government.
Okay, so how do they plan to actually do that? What are the mechanisms?
Right. So the executive order sets up two key things. First, a national design studio. Second, and this is probably the most important part, a chief design officer within the executive branch. And this chief design officer, they're not just some figurehead. No, they're given really substantial authority. Their responsibilities are pretty broad. Recruiting top design talent, maybe from the private sector, coordinating with all executive departments and agencies, and advising on how to cut down on, you know, duplicative design costs by standardizing things across the whole federal government. Agencies are specifically told, look, prioritize improvements for those high-impact websites and physical places people use every day. And the U.S. web design system, that's slated for an update, working with this new officer. Oh, and one more thing, this whole setup, it's temporary, set to terminate in 3 years. Which suggests, you know, a really focused, ragged push.
Interesting. Temporary. And does this fit with anything they've done before? Is there a pattern here?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you look back, this initiative is very consistent with previous executive actions. Remember, making America beautiful again by improving our national parks.
Yeah.
It shows that consistent emphasis on aesthetics and sort of national pride as fundamental policy goals. Now they're just extending that to the very interface of government itself.
So it's not just a facelift, then? It's more like a strategic move to centralize control over the government's entire public face. A subtle, but wow, potentially powerful assertion of executive authority. And if I'm getting this right, controlling the design isn't just about aesthetics. It's about controlling the actual pathways people use to get services and information. Is that right? How does that centralized authority actually work to, you know, shape that public identity you mentioned?
Precisely. That centralized authority, held by the chief design officer and the National Design Studio. It can dictate how information is presented, which services get the spotlight, even the overall tone, the feel of government interaction. This kind of standardization can be a powerful yet, you know, subtle tool. It can build public trust, shape perceptions in ways that are maybe more nuanced than just putting out policy statements. It creates this new lever, right? A lever of centralized executive influence over the public-facing identity of the entire federal bureaucracy. And that could lead to a more uniform, perhaps even an ideologically curated presentation to the federal government, to, well, to you, the American people.
Wow. Okay. So for our listeners, this could mean, yes, maybe a better experience using government services, filing taxes, getting a passport, whatever. That sounds good. But it also subtly shapes how you perceive the government itself.
Exactly. It encourages you, the listener, to think critically about the why behind those design choices. Is it really just about efficiency and making things easy? Or is there a specific message, a desired perception, kind of baked into the very design of how your government talks to you? It's a fascinating layer to think about in terms of how power is actually exercised.
That's a really great point, encouraging that critical thought. Okay, let's pivot now from the aesthetic to something very tangible. Infrastructure, federal infrastructure. This next executive action is a presidential permit. Issued on August 20th, 2025. It's for Cameron County, Texas, to build a new pedestrian border crossing at the Gateway International Bridge. Now, this might seem pretty straightforward, right? It sounds like a local thing responding to a real local need. But what's the federal angle here? Where does the balance of power actually lie in something like this?
Right. Well, this presidential permit, it's a direct response to a request Cameron County put in back in December 2024. And the local context is absolutely key here. You've got Brownsville, Texas, dealing with major traffic congestion, safety issues for something like, I think, 12,000 pedestrians crossing the Gateway International Bridge every single day for work, school, shopping, you know, cross-border trade and movement. It's just fundamental to the South Texas economy. We're talking over 382,000 jobs in Texas, billions added to the state GDP. So all that congestion at the border, it's a real economic drag, costs billions every year. So yeah, a dedicated walkway makes a lot of sense locally, improves safety, efficiency, cuts down on that economic cost. It's a clear local need.
Okay, so the need is real, but where does the federal government come in and what are the terms? You mentioned stringent controls.
Extremely stringent. The framework for federal control and especially the cost burdens established by this permit, it's remarkable. Cameron County is explicitly responsible for all costs, and I mean all of them, not just building it and maintaining it. They also have to provide suitable inspection facilities, all the needed infrastructure upgrades, even the equipment for federal agencies like Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and all of this at absolutely zero cost to the U.S. government. Plus, before they can even break ground, the county has to get a donation acceptance proposal approved by CBP and the GSA, the General Services Administration. They need concurrence from the International Boundary and Water Commission, and the Department of State has to confirm a formal diplomatic agreement with Mexico. It's a whole gauntlet of federal hoops to jump through.
Wow. Okay, so the feds give permission, but the locals pay for everything, including the federal facilities needed for the permission. That seems unusual.
It is. And what this strategic blueprint really shows is how the administration can, well, facilitate new infrastructure that aligns with its border management goals without needing any money from Congress. They just offload all the costs onto local government sponsor. But here's where the power dynamic really snaps into focus. The president retains sweeping and continuous federal authority. The permit explicitly states the president can terminate, revoke, or amend this permit at any time at his sole discretion. End quote. The county also can't sell it or make big operational changes without getting prior presidential approval. This really represents a significant expansion of executive power over border infrastructure. It concentrates the ultimate authority right there in the White House while requiring zero federal dollars.
That's a really critical point about who actually holds the reins, even when the money comes from somewhere else. Does this kind of model where federal power grows without federal spending pop up elsewhere in their strategy? And for you listening, it's vital to grasp this. Yeah, local needs might start the project, but the ultimate control, the long-term fate of these critical assets, that stays firmly centralized in the White House.
It absolutely does. We'll definitely see echoes of this kind of approach as we keep going. It's a recurring theme for sure.
Okay, sticking with executive actions for a moment longer. We also have this OMB memorandum M2532, that's Office of Management and Budget. It's titled Preventing Improper Payments and Protecting Privacy Through Do Not Pay, and it was issued on August 20th, 2025. Now, look, the goal of fiscal accountability, preventing improper payments, that's obviously critical. You mentioned the number earlier, something like $2.8 trillion lost cumulatively since fiscal year 2003. That's just astronomical. But the title itself, including protecting privacy, it flags a potential tension, doesn't it? So for the listener, why should we maybe be a bit concerned about changes to something like the Privacy Act, even if the goal, like stopping government waste, is something everyone agrees on?
That is the core tension, exactly. This OMB memo, it's a direct shot at tackling this persistent problem of improper payments. And those are defined pretty broadly. You know, fraud, payments going to people or for services that aren't eligible, duplicates, sometimes just simple errors in amounts. The memo states, quite bluntly actually, that the Treasury Department's existing Do Not Pay system, the DNP system, has, quote, failed as a tool for comprehensive screening. So, to fix this, and this is supposedly in line with the Payment Integrity Information Act of 2019, or PIA, it mandates that all executive agencies conduct a thorough review of available databases to check eligibility before any federal money goes out the door.
Okay, so more checking up front. How do they enable that? What changes?
Yeah. Well, to make this happen, the memo orders two really significant modifications to how agencies follow the Privacy Act of 1974. First, by September 19th, 2025, that's pretty quick, agencies have to change their system of records notices, or SORNs. These SORNs are basically the public notices explaining how federal agencies collect, keep, and use your personal information. They have to add a standardized routine use clause, and this clause will specifically allow them to share personal records with the Treasury Department for DNP screening, you know, to prevent or get back improper payments. Second, and this one is, well, quite significant, it sets up a 4-year waiver of the Privacy Act's formal computer matching agreement requirements, specifically for the DNP program. Now, these agreements, they're usually seen as really key safeguards. They're designed to ensure accountability, due process, data security when agencies compare records across different systems, often involving really sensitive personal data. The memo says the waiver aims to minimize administrative barriers to sharing this data.
A 4-year waiver? That sounds like a big change to how things normally work under the Privacy Act.
It is. And it really highlights this fundamental tension, right, between the administration's goal of fiscal accountability and the principles of individual privacy. Look, reducing fraud and waste is important. Nobody disputes that. But the mechanism they've chosen relies on a massive expansion of centralized data sharing and matching, all flowing through Treasury. It systematically lowers, or at least streamlines, key procedural protections that are built into the Privacy Act. This sweeping routine use clause, combined with a waiver of formal matching agreements, it represents a really significant shift in the federal privacy framework. Now, the memo does talk about safeguards, but the primary function here is clearly to speed up data flows that were previously more restricted. It's a clear policy choice. Prioritize fiscal efficiency, which, yes, could prevent more improper payments. But at the same time, it definitely increases the risks of data misuse, errors from bad data matching, and maybe a gradual erosion of the Privacy Act's core protections.
So if I'm hearing you right, it's essentially a trade-off. They're aiming for more efficiency in stopping waste by casting a much wider data net, but potentially sacrificing some of those established privacy safeguards to do it. Okay, for you listening, this is a clear challenge to think about. What's the long-term impact on the federal privacy framework? Where should that line be drawn between government efficiency and protecting your personal data? It's a balancing act, and the consequences are very real. All right, moving from the executive branch over to the judicial. These past few days also brought some really pivotal court rulings, rulings that are profoundly shaping executive power. On August 21st, 2025, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision. This was in National Institutes of Health v. American Public Health Association. And this decision allows the administration to terminate $783 million in NIH biomedical research grants that were linked to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or DEI. Now, this seems less about the actual policy, the DEI stuff, and more about the legal process. What was the court's reasoning here? And what's the shadow docket that Justice Jackson mentioned in her dissent?
You're right. The majority's decision, which was brief and unsigned, focused almost purely on procedure. It didn't really get into the merits of the anti-DEI policy itself. The court basically determined that the legal challenge to stopping these grants, it likely belonged in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. That's a specialized court, handles monetary claims against the federal government. The reasoning was that the grants represented an obligation to pay money, so therefore the claim should go to the federal claims court, not a regular federal district court.
Okay, so just sending it to a different court. But does that mean the administration can just cancel all DEI grants now?
Well, here's a crucial distinction. The court actually declined to stop the part of the lower court's ruling that had invalidated the NIH's internal guidance documents about DEI. So what that means is, yes, the specific $783 million in existing grants can be terminated now, but the administration is blocked from using that particular anti-DEI directive to cancel future grants based on that same guidance. So it's kind of a split decision, you know, affects current money, but puts a block on future cancellations using that specific rule.
And how does this fit into the administration's broader goals?
Well, this ruling fits right into the administration's wider effort to eliminate what it calls radical and wasteful government DEI programs. This $783 million, it's just a fraction of what's estimated maybe $12 billion halted across different agencies. Remember, the initial injunction, the one the Supreme Court ruling partly overturned, came from U.S. District Judge William Young, and he called the administration's actions arbitrary and discriminatory, even government racial discrimination. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in her dissent, was really sharp. She criticized the majority for using the emergency shadow docket for such a big ruling with just, quote, a half paragraph of reasoning.
Okay, hang on. For our listeners who might not know, can you quickly explain what the shadow docket actually is and why is using it here so controversial?
Sure, yeah. The shadow docket, it's basically the term used for the Supreme Court's practice of issuing orders and summary decisions, often really quickly, without the full briefing, without oral arguments, and often without detailed explanations that you get in their regular signed opinions. These are typically supposed to be for emergency situations, urgent procedural matters. But critics argue it's been used more and more for really substantive policy decisions, basically bypassing the usual transparency and deliberation of the court's main docket. Justice Jackson's point is that using this faster, less transparent process for a ruling this significant, affecting hundreds of millions in research funding, is deeply problematic. It avoids proper judicial scrutiny, in her view.
Okay, got it. So if we connect this back to the bigger picture you mentioned.
Right. This ruling is a prime example of what you could call jurisdictional rerouting. It's being used as a really potent tool to get around immediate judicial blocks. By pushing the legal fight over the Court of Federal Claims, which is known for being slower, more technical, the administration effectively neutralizes the immediate power of the district court to stop these actions. It lets the grant cuts go ahead. And this sets a precedent, right? Future executive actions canceling federal funding might be shielded from quick, broad review in district courts. That weakens the judiciary's ability to act as a swift check on the executive's power over the purse. So for you, the listener, this decision could impact scientific research, public health, and really shows how focusing on court procedure can fundamentally reshape the government's ability to push through controversial policies.
So basically, the court isn't ruling on whether the policy itself is right or wrong. They're just saying you're asking the question in the wrong room. And redirecting it like that effectively lets the administration move forward. That's a powerful tool indeed. Okay, on a similar note, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling on August 20th, 2025. This one vacated or canceled a preliminary injunction against a mass reduction in force, a RIF, or mass layoff at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. This now allows the termination of, what, roughly 90% of its staff, over 1,400 employees. That's huge. What was the legal reasoning here, and what does this mean for consumer protection?
The legal reasoning from the D.C. Circuit majority, in an opinion written by Judge Gregory Katsas, it actually closely mirrored the jurisdictional focus we just saw in the Supreme Court's NIH ruling. The court said that the district court, the one that issued the original injunction stopping the layoffs, simply didn't have the proper jurisdiction to even hear the case. The majority argued that the only way for federal employees to challenge a RIF, a mass layoff like this, is through the specialized administrative review process set up by the Civil Service Reform Act, the CSRA. Essentially, they said, look, if you have a claim about losing your job in RIF, you have to go through that specific internal administrative channel. You can't bring it to a federal district court.
And this comes after a sustained effort to dismantle the CFPB.
Right. Exactly. This decision lands right in the middle of the administration's ongoing sustained effort to dismantle the CFPB. Remember, this agency was created specifically after the 2008 financial crisis to protect consumers from predatory financial stuff. Critics, including the union representing the employees, the National Treasury Employees Union, they've argued really strongly that these mass layoffs are just an unlawful unilateral attempt to basically abolish an agency that Congress mandated. And even with the injunction temporarily stopping the layoffs, the CFPB's ability to function was already severely crippled. Reports said it had stopped most investigations, dropped pending cases, was closing compliance issues without even checking. Plus, its budget had already been nearly cut in half by that One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So this ruling now removes the last legal barrier to effectively incapacitating the agency. Judge Nina Pillard wrote a really forceful dissent, calling the majority's decision untenable. She argued it basically lets the agency's existence become a matter of, quote, unilateral and unexplained presidential edict.
So, okay, let's connect the dots here. The CFPB ruling, the NIH ruling we just talked about, both coming out within a day of each other, are they showing a clear, consistent judicial pattern? It almost sounds like they're validating a strategy to deconstruct the administrative state, but doing it on purely procedural grounds. Are the courts kind of sidestepping the bigger constitutional questions here?
That's precisely right. That's exactly what appears to be happening. In both cases, the courts avoided the substantive constitutional questions. Questions like, can the president effectively neutralize a federal agency or a research program just through executive action alone? End quote. Instead, they focus solely on, well, the proper legal venue. Where should this fight happen? End quote. And by forcing these challenges into those narrower, specialized administrative channels like the CSRA process for the CFPB or the Court of Federal Claims for the NIH grants, it becomes incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible, for opponents to legally challenge the broader strategic decisions themselves. This gives the executive branch immense latitude, huge freedom, to neutralize agencies it doesn't like with very limited immediate judicial recourse. For you, the listener, this directly impacts the millions of consumers who relied on the CFPB for protection. And maybe more broadly, it raises really serious questions about the stability, the accountability of other federal agencies that could become targets of similar administrative deconstruction tactics. It's a profound shift in how the executive can reshape government without needing direct action from Congress. #33 Regulatory realignment across key agencies.
Okay, so it's clear the judiciary is playing a major role here, often enabling executive actions, frequently just on procedural grounds. Now let's turn to how the administration's agenda is actually translating into tangible regulatory changes by the key federal agencies themselves. On August 22nd, 2025, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, announced its long-awaited decisions on a whole bunch of 175 small refinery exemption petitions. This is under the Renewable Fuel Standard Program, the RFS. Now, this program, it's always been a battleground, hasn't it? Pitting the oil refining industry against the biofuel sector. How did the EPA manage this this minefield?
Yeah, this decision tackled a really substantial backlog, 175 of these small refinery exemptions, or SREs. And they covered compliance years, all the way from 2016 up to 2024. Just as a quick reminder, the RFS program mandates that our transportation fuel contains a minimum volume of renewable fuels, like ethanol, but it allows small refineries to petition for an exemption if they can show, quote, disproportionate economic hardship. So out of these 175 petitions, the EPA granted 63 full exemptions, 77 got partial exemptions, like 50%, 28 were denied outright, and 7 were just deemed ineligible.
Okay, so a lot of exemptions granted, some partial, some denied. How did the different sides react? Predictably, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely predictable. The reactions were very mixed, really reflecting that deep-seated conflict. The biofuels industry, you know, groups like the Renewable Fuels Association, the American Coalition for Ethanol, they expressed, let's say, cautious approval. Now, they still argue that these small refineries aren't really facing economic hardship, but they praise the EPA's stated intention to reallocate the exempted volumes for future compliance years. See, this reallocation mechanism, it's crucial for them because it's supposed to ensure that the total national blending mandates set by Congress are actually met in the end, even if some refineries get a pass. On the flip side, the refining industry, speaking through the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, they voiced strong opposition specifically to that reallocation part. While they were kind of relieved the EPA finally acted on the backlog, they argued that reallocating these volumes onto the other obligated parties, the ones who didn't get exemptions, would impose billions in extra costs. They claimed it would harm U.S. energy security by maybe increasing reliance on imported feedstocks and unfairly burden consumers.
So how did the EPA actually structure this? You mentioned future reallocation.
Right. The regulatory mechanics here are actually quite clever. It reveals a really carefully structured compromise. For the exemptions they granted for the older compliance years, 2016 through 2022, the EPA announced it will not reallocate the waived volumes. The reasoning they gave is that the RINs, those are the renewable identification numbers, the tradable credits used for RFS compliance from those years have basically expired. They can't be used anymore. However, for the exemptions granted for 2023 and onwards, the EPA committed to issuing a supplemental proposal, and that proposal will reallocate the lost gallons. This would effectively increase the blending mandates for the non-exempt parties, probably in the 2026 and 2027 compliance years.
Huh. So it's like a split decision based on time. One rule for the past, another for the future. What does this kind of calculated compromise tell us about the administration's broader regulatory approach?
This bifurcated approach, yeah, it's a really calculated political and regulatory compromise. It's designed specifically to manage these deeply competing interests. It cleverly avoids giving a complete victory to either side. See, by granting a large number of exemptions, it provides significant regulatory relief to the oil and gas industry, which they wanted. But by committing to future reallocation, it offers a crucial assurance to the biofuels and agricultural sectors, saying, hey, the RFS program's integrity will be maintained going forward. That distinction between past and future compliance years is really the key to this balancing act. It lets the EPA clear out a backlog without completely alienating a powerful constituency. So this really demonstrates a pretty sophisticated regulatory strategy. They're advancing deregulatory goals where they can while trying to mitigate the political fallout from, you know, a key rural constituency. For you, the listener, these complex regulatory decisions, they directly impact energy markets, fuel prices at the pump, the agricultural sector. It really showcases that intricate balancing act the government tries to strike between powerful, often conflicting industries.
That really is a textbook example of regulatory finesse, isn't it? Trying to navigate those political pressures. Okay, let's shift gears now to the financial regulatory world. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has also taken some pretty decisive steps recently to liberalize market access for retail investors, regular folks. This seems to reflect that philosophy of deregulation, maybe what some people are calling democratizing finance. But while expanding access to investments sounds good, it often comes with a big increase in risk exposure, doesn't it? Am I reading this right? Is the SEC essentially telling retail investors, okay, here's the key to the casino, but hey, don't blame us if you lose your shirt. Is that maybe too simplistic, or does it capture the shift here?
Chuckles. Well, that analogy, while maybe a little dramatic, Alex, it absolutely captures the essence of what seems to be a profound philosophical shift happening at the SEC. This past week alone saw two key actions that really exemplify this trend.
Okay, what were they?
First, on August 15th, 2025, the SEC staff formally rescinded, basically got rid of, a decades-old informal guidance. This unwritten rule had significantly restricted retail access to private funds. It required registered closed-end funds, those are accessible to the general public, to limit their investments in illiquid private funds to no more than 15% of their total assets. If a fund went over that 15% limit, it could previously only be sold to accredited investors, you know, people with high income or net worth. Getting rid of this guidance now basically opens the door for fund managers to create and market products with heavy allocations to things like private equity and venture capital directly to the mass retail market.
Wow. Okay, so opening up private equity to everyone. And the second action?
Second, the SEC has continued to smooth the path for cryptocurrency assets to get into the mainstream financial system, mainly through ETFs, exchange-traded funds. During this period, the agency issued notices about proposed rule changes. These would increase the position and exercise limits for options on various spot Bitcoin ETFs like the ones managed by Grayscale and Bitwise. And this follows on earlier, really landmark decisions in 2025 that approved what's called in-kind creations and redemptions for crypto asset ETPs, exchange-traded products. That was a technical change, but it makes these products much more efficient for the companies issuing them and for investors.
Okay, so the stated goal is expanding opportunities for regular Americans to get into assets that used to be exclusive.
Exactly. That's the stated implication. Allowing ordinary Americans access to asset classes' potential returns that were previously just for the wealthy or big institutions. However, this democratization, as you call it, it comes with a really significant increase in risk exposure for the retail public. The guardrails that are being removed here, they were originally put in place specifically to protect non-sophisticated investors from the unique dangers of these kinds of markets. Think about it. Private funds are notoriously opaque, hard to value, highly illiquid, meaning you might not be able to sell your shares quickly, maybe not at all if things go bad. And cryptocurrency markets, well, we all know they're characterized by extreme volatility,
right,
and they're definitely susceptible to fraud and manipulation. These were the very concerns that made the SEC hesitant for so long to approve these kinds of products.
Well, it's a real philosophical shift then from protecting investors to what?
It seems to be a shift away from a more, let's say, paternalistic model of investor protection towards a framework of caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. The burden of doing the homework, the due diligence, it effectively shifts from the regulator onto the individual investor. And that investor may lack the resources, the time, the expertise to really assess these complex risks adequately. Now, look, this approach might foster financial innovation, maybe, but it also introduces new vulnerabilities into the financial system. What happens in a market downturn? Could we see a rush of retail investors trying to pull their money out of these newly accessible funds? For funds holding those illiquid private assets, they could force them into fire sales, selling assets at huge discounts, creating a negative feedback loop with potentially systemic consequences. So for you, the listener, yes, there are increased investment opportunities here. But there are also substantially heightened risks. Doing your own personal due diligence in this new, more permissive regulatory environment. It's more critical than ever before. #, #ChatForVigo. Foreign policy and national security posture.
Okay. These internal shifts in executive power, regulatory philosophy, they're clearly substantial, huge. Now, let's broaden our view out to the administration's foreign policy and national security posture, which also saw some pretty intense activity. It really seems like the administration is leaning heavily on sanctions as its primary tool of statecraft. On August 20th, 2025, the U.S. Department of State announced a new round of sanctions, this time against officials of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, targeting officials from allied nations like Canada and France. That seems like an extraordinary step, doesn't it? What were the specifics, and what kind of message does this blast out to our international partners?
It was absolutely an extraordinary action, Alex. And the message it sends is, well, pretty unequivocal. Acting under an existing executive order, 14203, Secretary of State Marco Rubio designated four specific individuals. They were Judge Kimberly Prost from Canada, Judge Nicolas Guillou from France, Deputy Prosecutor Nasrat Shamim Khan from Fiji, and Deputy Prosecutor Mame Mandiaye Niang from Senegal. The immediate impact. Any assets these individuals might have in U.S. jurisdictions are frozen, and all U.S. persons, U.S. companies are prohibited from doing any business with them.
And the reason given, why these specific people?
The administration's stated rationale was that these officials were directly involved in the ICC's efforts to either investigate or prosecute U.S. or Israeli nationals without the consent of the U.S. or Israel. Specifically, Judge Prost was targeted apparently for her role in an investigation looking into U.S. personnel actions in Afghanistan, while Judge Kiyu and the two deputy prosecutors were sanctioned because of their involvement in the ICC, issuing arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant related to alleged war crimes in Gaza. The administration formally labeled the ICC a national security threat and an instrument of lawfare. They strongly reasserted their policy to protect U.S. sovereignty and that of its key allies from what they deem illegitimate and baseless actions by the court.
Wow. How did the rest of the world react to this?
Yeah.
The international reaction was incredibly swift and very starkly divided. The Israeli government, as you might expect, welcomed the move, called it a decisive act against what they termed a smear campaign. But the sanctions drew widespread condemnation pretty much everywhere else. The ICC itself denounced the action, calling it a flagrant attack against the independence of an impartial judicial institution. The United Nations expressed serious concern, and France, a key U.S. ally, stated it was dismayed by the sanctioning of one of his own judges.
So this is really a stark assertion of U.S. sovereignty over international law, then.
It is. It penalizes officials of a multilateral institution, including citizens of allied nations, for basically carrying out their mandated duties. This action effectively declares that U.S. sovereignty, and by extension the sovereignty of its key allies like Israel, is superior to the jurisdiction of international legal bodies like the ICC. For you, the listener, this demonstrates a powerful exercise of U.S. leverage, absolutely. But it's also a move that could significantly strain relationships with key allies and fundamentally reshape the future of international legal cooperation. It's a very clear signal that this administration prioritizes its view of national sovereignty over multilateral legal frameworks, even when those frameworks involve close partners.
That's a very clear statement indeed on where they stand regarding international law. And it seems that focus on economic pressure didn't stop there. The very next day, August 21st, 2025, we saw coordinated sanctions coming from both the Treasury and State Departments, this time targeting Iran's so-called shadow fleet and its illicit oil export network. This feels like a clear continuation of the maximum pressure campaign we've heard about.
Absolutely, Alex. This action is a direct continuation of that National Security Presidential Memorandum 2, NSPM2, which outlines the maximum pressure campaign. The stated goal is to deny the Iranian regime the revenue it uses to fund its nuclear program, support terrorist groups, and generally destabilize the Middle East.
Who exactly did they target this time?
The sanctions hit multiple entities and individuals. Mm. The Treasury Department designated a Greek national, Antonios Margaritis and his quite extensive network of shipping companies and vessels, accusing them of transporting Iranian petroleum. At the same time, the State Department imposed sanctions on two China-based entities. One was Qingdao Port Hai Dongyeku Oil Products Co., Ltd. The other was Yangshan Shengang International Petroleum Storage and Transportation Co., Ltd. These companies operate crude oil terminals and storage facilities in China. And the administration specifically called out the Dongyeku port as being the largest entry point for illicit Iranian crude oil into China, highlighting their, quote, vital role in Iran's oil supply chain.
Okay, so if we take both sets of sanctions together, the ones against the ICC officials and these new measures against Iran's oil network, what does this tell us about the administration's broader strategy? Are they really weaponizing the U.S. financial system?
That's exactly what it looks like. What both the ICC and Iran sanctions reveal, even though they're aimed at very different targets, is a unified foreign policy approach. An approach centered on the aggressive weaponization of the U.S. financial system to enforce a very sovereignty-centric worldview. The Iran sanctions, in particular, really demonstrate this global reach. They force third-country actors, like those Greek shippers or the Chinese port operators, to effectively choose. Do they facilitate business with a U.S. adversary like Iran, or do they maintain their access to the U.S. dollar-denominated global financial system? It's a stark choice. This approach consistently relies on unilateral economic coercion rather than traditional diplomacy. Now, it can be highly effective in the short term, applying immense pressure, but it also risks alienating allies, as we saw with the ICC sanctions. And over the long term, it could incentivize adversaries, maybe even competitors, to speed up their efforts to develop alternative financial systems, potentially eroding a key pillar of American global power. For you, the listener, this illustrates how U.S. economic power is wielded across the globe, affecting not just adversaries, but also third-party facilitators. And it has potential long-term impacts on global economic structures and who controls them. It signals a real willingness to apply significant pressure, even if it means challenging established international norms.
So sanctions are clearly a powerful hammer in their foreign policy toolbox. But what about traditional diplomacy? Were there any engagements on that front?
Well, on August 21st, 2025, we did see confirmation of an agreement for Uganda to accept certain migrants deported from the U.S. This kind of third country deportation arrangement, it's a concept we've heard before. But is this a straightforward humanitarian effort, or does it fit into that broader, more transactional foreign policy model we've been discussing?
Well, it fits very neatly into that transactional model, Alex. The Ugandan Foreign Ministry confirmed the agreement, but described it as temporary. And it came with conditions. Uganda apparently won't accept deportees who have criminal records or any unaccompanied minors. And they've expressed a preference for accepting people of African nationalities. Now, this arrangement, it's a key component of the administration's quite stringent immigration enforcement policy. It provides a destination for individuals who maybe can't be easily returned to their home countries for various reasons.
And the transactional part, where does that come in? The context strongly suggests a quid pro quo. The U.S. State Department confirmed that Secretary Rubio had a phone call with Ugandan President Museveni, and the focus of the call, quote, migration, reciprocal trade, and commercial ties. Rubio also apparently thanked Uganda for its role as, quote, a model of regional stability. This framing really implies that Uganda's cooperation on a key U.S. domestic priority migration is being linked to favorable treatment in other areas of the bilateral relationship. This was kind of underscored when a senior Ugandan official publicly questioned why his country would take in, quote, unwanted people without some form of compensation, while also noting discussions were happening about visas, tariffs, sanctions, and related issues. Unsurprisingly, this agreement has drawn really sharp criticism from human rights advocates. Some have likened to human trafficking and argue it might violate international law regarding non-refoulement.
Human trafficking. Wow, that's incredibly strong language for what's being framed as a diplomatic agreement. Does this type of deal, focusing on individual country negotiations rather than broader frameworks, have a specific name in foreign policy circles? Is this a recognized strategy?
It does. And it is. This agreement is a prime example of what's often called a hub-and-spoke foreign policy model. The U.S. acts as the central hub, engaging with individual countries, the spokes, on a very tailored, often transactional basis, usually to achieve specific, often domestically driven, objectives. This approach tends to de-emphasize broad multilateral alliances. It offers flexibility, maybe more leverage in one-on-one negotiations. But it can also prove less effective for tackling complex global challenges that require collective action. And some argue it fosters a more volatile international environment, where relationships are built more on shifting short-term interests rather than enduring alliances or shared values. For you, the listener, this raises significant humanitarian questions, and it clearly showcases a shift in diplomatic strategy towards these kinds of transactional deals over more traditional alliances. And that impacts international relations and human rights standards.
Okay, and just briefly on that note of bilateral engagement, Secretary Rubio also met with Turkmenistan's Foreign Minister Rashid Meredov on August 20th. Less dramatic than the sanctions or migration deals, obviously, but does this still fit that pattern, that individualized, interest-driven foreign policy?
Absolutely. Even though it's more conventional diplomacy, it still fits the pattern. The discussion reportedly centered on the current state and prospects for the development of bilateral cooperation. Specifically, they talked about political and diplomatic cooperation, strengthening their economic partnership, mentioning the Turkmen-American Business Council, and exploring opportunities in investment, technology, plus expanding cooperation in education, science, and culture. So while it's more traditional on the surface, it still fits that hub-and-spoke model by focusing on these discrete, specific areas of mutual economic or strategic interest. It's about finding those particular points of leverage and cooperation with individual nations, rather than operating primarily through broader multilateral frameworks. For you, the listener, it just shows how even seemingly minor diplomatic engagements can reinforce these broader strategic preferences for bilateral, interest-driven relationships. Hashtag TechTagVFight. Legislative branch status and outlook.
Okay, so we've seen just a flurry of activity from the executive branch, from the judicial branch, making major policy shifts, asserting power left and right. But what about the third branch? What about the legislative branch? How is Congress operating during this exact same period, August 20th to the 23rd, 2025? I have a feeling the contrast here is going to be pretty stark.
You are absolutely right, Alex. Stark is definitely the word. While the other branches were incredibly active, the U.S. Congress was largely quiescent, basically inactive. From August 20th through the 23rd, this period was marked by what you can only really describe as profound legislative inertia. And that effectively creates a noticeable power vacuum.
So what were they actually doing?
Or not
doing.
All right, let's look at the details. The records for the 119th Congress, which, remember, currently has a Republican majority in both the House and the Senate, show minimal activity. Very little. In the House of Representatives, the official calendar for Thursday, August 21st, 2025, it indicates absolutely no floor activity. None. The most recent recorded floor action before this date was simply an adjournment. Now, there was reportedly a procedural vote on something called a congressional map scheduled for August 20th, but there's no evidence of any major legislative debate, certainly no passage of any significant bills during this specific time frame we're looking at. Yes, some new bills were introduced around August 19th, like HB 4998 about armed forces oversight or HB 5009 concerning the GSA's fine arts program, but these are clearly at the very, very earliest stages, nowhere near becoming law.
Okay, so the House was quiet. What about the Senate?
Very similar situation over in the Senate. It did convene briefly on Friday, August 22nd, but only for what's called a pro forma session. For those listening who might not know, a pro forma session is just a very brief meeting. It often lasts only minutes. No actual legislative business gets done.
Yeah.
It's mainly used to satisfy the constitutional requirement that the chamber meets, keeps the session legally continuous, but it's not for actual legislating. And just like the House, the Senate's official calendar shows no floor activity at all for Thursday, August 21st. The last time they conducted any substantive legislative business, according to the records, was way back on August 2nd, well before our review period started. And the chamber wasn't even scheduled to return for regular business until the following Tuesday, August 26th.
Wow. So, okay, we have an executive branch actively pushing this wide-ranging agenda, a judiciary interpreting rules in ways that seem to, well, facilitate that agenda, and a legislative branch that's essentially on summer break or just close to it. What's the real consequence of that legislative inaction? It can't just be neutral, can it? Doesn't matter that they're quiet. That's the absolutely critical point, Alex. Legislative inaction is not a neutral factor. Not at all. It has profound consequences for the balance of power. When Congress fails to legislate on pressing issues, whether it's consumer financial protection or environmental rules, immigration enforcement, even how foreign policy is conducted, it effectively cedes the policymaking initiative to the executive branch. It just hands it over by default. Think about it.
all the really consequential actions we've discussed today, dismantling the CFPB administratively, setting the RFS levels, negotiating international migration deals, imposing sanctions, every single one occurred without any new legislative input, without constraint, without direct oversight from Congress during this period. The administration is acting based on its interpretation of existing laws, existing statutory authorities, and Congress, simply by being inactive, is not stepping in to clarify those authorities or expand them or limit them.
So it creates a kind of cycle.
Exactly.
It creates this self-reinforcing cycle. The absence of new laws from Congress creates a policy void. The executive branch feels empowered, maybe even obligated sometimes, to fill that void through unilateral action, using the tools it has. And that executive action, in turn, tends to further marginalize the legislative process. It reinforces the perception that the real power, the place where things actually get done, resides in the White House. So this current legislative stasis, this quiet period, it's therefore a critical enabling condition for the expansion of executive power that we've observed. It is, at least temporarily, transforming the U.S. system of governance away from one of shared powers, checks and balances, towards a model that's much more dominated by presidential directives, agency rulemaking, and then judicial review of those actions. For you, the listener, this really emphasizes how congressional inaction directly empowers the executive branch. It leads to significant policy changes happening without direct legislative debate or broad consensus, potentially eroding that foundational balance of powers we rely on. #, #, #, synthesis and forward-looking analysis.
Okay, so what does this all mean? When we really bring all these pieces together, the executive directives, those judicial rulings, the regulatory shifts, the foreign policy moves, it really paints a remarkably clear picture, doesn't it? A picture of a coherent, quite assertive governing philosophy at work. So how would you synthesize all these diverse actions? What's the overarching understanding of the state of the federal government right now based on just these few days?
Yeah, when you look at all these actions together, Alex, from August 20th to the 23rd, they really aren't just disparate events. They feel like interconnected maneuvers. And they reveal, I think, a very distinct governance model emerging or solidifying.
Oh.
I see four major thematic convergences, four big trends cutting across all the branches of government that were actually active during this short period.
Okay, what are they?
First, and maybe the most prominent, is the clear centralization of executive authority. We saw this with the America by Design initiative, right? Creating a new executive officer to essentially control the public face of the entire federal government. It's evident in that OMB mandate on improper payments, funneling vast amounts of agency data through a single Treasury-controlled system. And it's right there in the Cameron County border permit, granting the president sole discretion over critical infrastructure, even if it's locally funded. Power is clearly gravitating towards the White House and its core administrative offices, like OMB.
Okay, centralization. What's the second theme?
The second major theme is the systematic deregulation and reshaping of the administrative state. Look at the actions taken to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau through those mass layoffs. The provision of widespread exemptions from the renewable fuel standard for oil refineries, the ideologically driven purge of DEI-related research grants at the NIH. This isn't just about rolling back a few regulations here and there. It feels like a much more deliberate deconstruction and realignment of agency missions to fit the administration's specific priorities.
Right. And the third, you mentioned the courts enabling this.
Exactly. Third, this entire agenda has been profoundly enabled by a really strategic use of the judiciary. Those pivotal rulings, the Supreme Court on NIH grants, the D.C. Circuit on the CFPB, they demonstrate a highly successful legal strategy. And that strategy relies heavily on procedural and jurisdictional arguments to achieve what are ultimately substantive policy wins. By essentially sidestepping the merits of the case, arguing you're in the wrong court, the administration has effectively neutralized immediate judicial checks on its power. It lets them proceed with controversial actions while the legal challenges get rerouted to slower, more technical forums.
Okay. Centralization, deregulation, reshaping, strategic use of courts. What's the fourth theme?
Finally, these domestic trends are mirrored quite closely by a unilateral and transactional foreign policy. The administration has shown a very clear preference for economic coercion over traditional diplomacy. We saw that with the aggressive use of sanctions against both an adversary like Iran and an international institution like the ICC. At the same time, its diplomatic engagements, like that migration deal with Uganda, they're structured as these bespoke transactional agreements, designed to serve specific U.S. interests rather than building broad multilateral coalitions based on shared values or long-term alliances.
So putting those four things together, okay, what kind of governance model does that paint?
Taken together, Alex, these themes point to a distinct governance model, one that really prioritizes executive speed, agility, and ideological conformity above almost everything else. It's a model that seems impatient with, well, legislative deliberation, with regulatory precedent, with international consensus building. It appears to be actively seeking to deconstruct elements of the post-war administrative state and the rules-based international order that it perceives as maybe impediments to American sovereignty and the exercise of presidential power. And critically, as we discussed, the concurrent inaction of the legislative branch has created this permissive environment, allowing this model to flourish with relatively minimal political friction or immediate oversight.
That's a really powerful synthesis. It truly shows how interconnected these seemingly separate actions really are, all potentially working in concert towards a specific vision. But looking ahead then, what are the potential flashpoints? What should you, our listener, be watching for as these trends continue to evolve? Where could things get rocky?
That's a really important question, Alex. Because this trajectory, if it continues, it definitely suggests several potential flashpoints across all these areas we've touched on.
Like what?
Well, first, we should anticipate ongoing legal and jurisdictional conflicts. Those legal battles over the NIH grants, the CFPB layoffs, they're not over. They're just moving to different venues.
Yeah.
The Court of Federal Claims, the Civil Service Review System. The outcomes there will be crucial in determining the ultimate legal durability of this strategy of deconstructing agencies through administrative means. And we should probably expect to see more use of this jurisdictional strategy in future challenges to executive actions. It's going to keep testing the boundaries of judicial review.
Okay, legal fights will continue. What else?
Second, there are significant potential flashpoints related to economic and market stability. That EPA supplemental rule on reallocating RFS volumes, the one they promised, that is guaranteed to be a major point of contention between the refining and biofuels industries. Billions of dollars are potentially at stake, huge economic consequences. And in the financial sector, the real impact of the SEC's deregulation opening up complex products to retail investors. That will likely only become truly apparent during the next period of significant market stress or downturn. That's when we'll see how resilient this new, more permissive framework actually is and whether it creates new vulnerabilities.
Makes sense. And internationally.
Third, in international relations, the administration's continued use of secondary sanctions, and especially sanctions against international bodies or officials from allied nations, that will almost certainly continue to strain relationships, particularly with European allies. This could, over time, accelerate efforts by other global powers to maybe create financial and diplomatic structures that are less reliant on the United States, less vulnerable to U.S. sanctions. And the long-term viability, the human rights implications of those third country migration deals, they will remain sources of international friction, legal challenges, and real-world impact on vulnerable individuals.
Okay, legal, economic, international. What's the biggest unknown?
Finally, and maybe most significantly, we have to watch the role of Congress. The biggest unknown really is the point at which the current legislative stasis might break. What could trigger Congress to reassert itself? Maybe a major domestic or international crisis? Or perhaps just a shift in the political calculation of the congressional leadership? Something could compel Congress to reassert its constitutional authority, maybe through aggressive oversight hearings, using its power of the purse, or eventually passing new legislation specifically designed to constrain executive action in some of these areas. That interplay between an activist executive branch and right now a relatively passive legislative branch, that remains the central and I think the most consequential dynamic in American governance today. For you, the listener, these potential flashpoints, they translate directly into real-world impacts on your life, your investments, the stability of our nation, and the international order.
Wow. That was an immense deep dive, covering an incredible scope and strategic depth, and all from just a few days of federal activity. August 20th to 23rd. Dissecting these actions, seeing how they fit into this larger interconnected picture, it really highlights the value of understanding these nuanced shifts in how our government operates.
Absolutely. Understanding these patterns, the underlying strategic shifts, it's just crucial for comprehending the evolving structure of governance. And its profound implications, both for domestic policy here at home and for international relations abroad. These aren't just isolated news items you skim past. They're truly pieces of a much larger unfolding puzzle that affects absolutely everyone.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, let me leave you with a provocative thought to consider. In an era marked by such rapid executive action and concurrent legislative inertia, how do you ensure accountability and maintain that crucial balance of power within your government? Something to mull over until our next deep dive.